false.
No, it's false.
It's false, yeah.
And as bad as globalist censorship is, and as much as they've been suppressing thousands of medical doctors and nurses here in the U.S. alone, not to mention around the world, the truth about COVID-19 is coming out. The truth about the vaccines not being vaccines, not protecting you, is coming out. The truth about the PCR test being fake is coming out. The truth about Bill Gates being behind all the companies is coming out. The fact that the Pfizer and the Moderna and the AstraZeneca and the Australian government vaccine and a whole bunch of others have been banned in Australia and South Africa and 21 countries in Europe and the Philippines and Russia.
Okay, so what are your first thoughts after hearing that?
Well, I'm a little confused, maybe. I don't really know. I mean, I suppose you're going to tell me what this has to do with chaos, and I'm very excited to hear it.
Yes. The man you just heard is named Alex Jones, and he has this show called InfoWars, which is kind of a leading conspiracy theorist show in America. And at first, you may not see a direct connection between this fragment and the politics of chaos. But that is a connection that I'm going to be making, because constant exposure to chaos essentially can lead to the creation of conspiracy theories. That is a very complex conversation, so I will have to lead you into it. Welcome to our Chaos Podcast. Today we are going to be talking about politics and conspiracy theories. My name is Ismay.
And I'm Monise, and we are students in the Humanities Honors Program at Utrecht University.
This podcast is part of an interactive journaling experience provided to you by our Honors Research Seminar Group, consisting of 7 Humanities Honors students. If you would like to partake in this journaling experience yourself, you can find a free PDF version of our interactive journal on our website, chaos101.sites.uu.nl, as well as further information on our research about chaos. Thank you for listening to our podcast.
So, we have a lot to discuss today, and we'll start with the concept of cultural hegemony and grand narrative to explain how individuals need cultural narratives to make sense of their chaotic environments. Then, we will explore what effect cultural hegemony and grand narrative can have on political discourse by investigating different venues where chaos is organized and where that organization is challenged.
Exactly. So the terms cultural hegemony and grand narrative are pretty difficult to define. So I'm going to try and phrase it as clearly as possible. So cultural hegemony refers to the rules that exist through ideological or cultural means. Usually hegemony is determined by social institutions such as the government or media. And they have a very large influence on values, norms, and the general worldview that the population will have. So, for example, we grew up here in the Netherlands, or at least I'm assuming you did too.
Yes, I did.
So, growing up here, we grew up in a democracy, so we likely have democratic values. And we grew up around a discourse of human rights, so we likely, at least I hope you do, believe in human rights.
Yes, I do.
We also grew up in a capitalist environment. Now, we may have a bit more criticism towards that, but...
Yes, we do.
But it's still an ideology that we grew up around and that's still widely accepted in our environment. And for example, the national religion here is Christianity, or Protestantism more specifically. And those are all part of the cultural hegemony, all things that help us mediate reality, all things that kind of help us organize our chaotic world in a way that, because it's cultural and most people in our culture are affected by the same worldviews, we have this like united way of looking at the world, and that is the cultural hegemony.
Is it kind of like an atmosphere kind of thing that you live in? Or it also reminds me of, I don't know if that's also in English, but like canon?
The canon is essentially the widely accepted narrative, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is actually a very good comparison to make.
Okay.
With cultural hegemony, hegemony also suggests that it is kind of a mandatory thing. And if you diverge from it, if you decide to, no, I don't believe in certain values, or I look at the world completely differently, then that can also make you an outsider in your cultural environment. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we'll be discussing when talking about conspiracy theories as well. But the important thing about cultural hegemony to remember is also that we don't always realize that something, one of our views, is part of our cultural hegemony. So, for example, I believe in, you know, the importance of human rights. But before looking into this, I didn't even think about, like, oh, that's, you know, not something that's universal necessarily.
Yeah.
So often we don't even realize how affected we are by the cultural views that are portrayed by people around us. And when looking at grand narrative, so these individual things that I mentioned are all aspects of cultural hegemony. So together, they form the cultural hegemony. And grand narratives are then kind of the manifestations of the cultural hegemony. So, for example, the human rights discourse, that is one grand narrative. And, say, Christianity, that's also a grand narrative. So that's kind of a story we tell ourselves literally about the world to make sense of it. And a very important aspect of grand narrative is that they can be very complex because they are created over time and not just by one person or one group. They can be very complex, and we really are able to somewhat adequately express the complexity of our reality with these grand narratives. If I had come to this world completely unaffected by cultural hegemony and grand narratives, I'd have come up with stories of my own. That's the idea, because the human mind works in a narrative way.
Yeah.
Essentially, like, you tell yourself stories about your life. That's also often how you think about things. In the last episode, you also talked about how you like to write, but even when you're not writing, you're still talking about yourself to yourself. Like, you're telling yourself stories about your life.
Right.
So that's one of the researchers that I read. His name is Agai Rose. He essentially wrote that grand narratives get to be complex so that we can kind of mediate our complex, chaotic environment to ourselves.
Yeah.
And because we tell stories about ourselves to ourselves and about the world to ourselves, we get to express a very complex reality in a very complex way because we have this medium. This grand narrative is what helps us structure the complex reality.
Yeah.
But what we'll be talking about today, if grand narrative kind of fails us, because cultural hegemony can be very oppressive. We have, of course, seen very sexist, racist, homophobic societies. Some societies, most societies still are, all of those things.
I think our society still is.
Yeah, definitely. To a different extent, obviously, than it used to be. But these are things that can be very oppressive and that people rebel against. So the cultural hegemony doesn't work for everybody. And not everybody manages to use our grand narratives to mediate their experiences of reality. So this is what leads us into the conspiracy theory conversation. But first, I would just like to hear from you. Having heard this definition of cultural hegemony and grand narrative, how do you see that reflected in your own life?
Well, this doesn't really relate to me personally, but I did think of this one course that I followed, world history. And grand narrative was actually one of the terms that we had to study, but then obviously from a historical perspective. But then it was more about that you have these, obviously, grand narratives, and they kind of tell the story of the world in a sense. But there's different kinds, and the bigger the narrative, like, the more likely it is that some stories get lost, and that's kind of what we were talking about. So we had to learn about that most of our history books and history courses in Western Europe focus on the entire world, but only from a Western European point of view, whereas with world history, we try, and it's really hard because obviously we are from Western Europe, so you always have this, like, almost institutionalized Western view on everything. But they really tried with this course to make us completely reject that point of view and study the Mongolian Empire and the Chinese Empire and all of these huge societies that were a lot bigger than, for example, the Roman Empire was. Yet we only ever learned about the Roman Empire because that existed in Western Europe. So that's, I think, the only way in which I'm kind of familiar with the term. But other than that, I'm probably going to be very much surprised by you.
Yes, that's really interesting that you say that, because I actually also found a source that talked about it from a historical perspective. And indeed, it says that, like, our changes in perspective have also kind of shattered the cultural authority of what a researcher called Lyotard called the master narrative, so that's similar to a grand narrative, of the West, including the institution of canonical autobiography. So that's, again, canonical.
Yeah.
And also, it talks about autobiography here because the book was about autobiographies. So again, the way we narrate our lives to ourselves are so affected by our cultural environments.
Yeah.
And so if you feel kind of left out by society, it can lead to protests in the form of, for example, Black Lives Matter. The existing cultural hegemony resulted in a systematic inequality. So it results in protests and people, you know, taking political action to improve the situation, or at least to try and improve the situation. And that's also, for example, what led to Stonewall, which was kind of the catalyst for queer rights movements. And of course, the Me Too whole situation. Those are all challenges to the cultural hegemony. And those are places where it's obviously, or at least from my perspective, from my grand narrative, it's very important that those conversations are being held.
Yeah.
But sometimes it can go, like, I'm going to say, quote unquote, wrong. And then it results in conspiracy theories. So if you feel kind of left out by the cultural hegemony, and as I will show you in one of the fragments in a second, many conspiracy theorists feel left out. Many start thinking conspiracy theories after they've had like a traumatic experience or something that's been very hard on them. And many have felt left out, for example, their whole lives. And they are just critical thinkers.
I did not know that, honestly, because I have a very stereotypical image in my head of what a conspiracy theorist looks like. And he takes, I'm going to say he, I'm sorry, but like also she, but like they, I guess, tick every box of like privilege that I can think of for some reason. I don't know why, but when I look at conspiracy theorists that I've seen, it's always, I always thought like, yeah, they did not fit into the cultural hegemony, but then I thought it was only about science, whereas they don't fit in that general Western view on science explaining everything. I had no idea that it went even further than that. So that's,
yes. So we're going to be listening to some fragments from of the Flat Earth documentary called Behind the Curve. And this is a documentary in which like scientists and flat earthers talk about their beliefs. And although, like, of course, you can't generalize conspiracy theorists. Like, some may be really privileged, but many are also really, like, normal critical thinkers. You can't really look at them through the lens of, oh, they're just kooky weirdos. They are just challenging the norms. And, you know, I believe they're not always right. But what they're doing is actually something that's very common in a democracy. We live in a democratic environment and critical thought is incredibly encouraged. And obviously that's not a bad thing, or at least, again, I think that because I grew up in a democracy. But if you have to think about everything for yourself, though, there is so much, like there are so many stimuli. And if you can't accept anything, you end up at like a Cartesian worldview. So this is where Descartes comes in. So he said, I think, therefore I am. So then that is the only thing you can know, essentially. Like, the rest may all just be a project of...
Yeah.
And if you start thinking about critically about everything, you can't be sure about anything. But that's not how we live our lives. Like, we need some narrative for ourselves, something to stimulate us. So if we just go, like, nothing is real, everything is... We have to question everything at all times. That is, of course, yeah, that leads us to simplify the world. Because, yeah, like, if we can't accept the complex grand narrative, we need to write a narrative of our own. But because we don't have, like, centuries of cultural heritage to take along with us, because we're starting afresh with a clean slate, our narratives become very simple. And that is also what the researcher I just mentioned, Agathe Rose, said. And that is what leads. Yeah, these simplified narratives can become conspiracy theories. But I also wrote my, like, a high school thesis about conspiracy theories. And for that thesis, I actually interviewed a Dutch psychologist researcher called Jan Willem van Prooyen. And he also told us that a lack of information is often what causes conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
If we don't have all the information, and in our chaotic world, of course, we cannot have all the information at all times, then we fill in the gaps ourselves. And the way we fill in the gaps tend to be simple. They tend to confirm our biases that we already have. And often it tends to be symmetrical. So, for example, a very big outcome like the pandemic must have a very big cause. So, like, the virus must have been made in a lab. I mean, we're not sure where the virus comes from, so I'm not saying anything about that. But
I thought it was a bat.
Yeah, that's the leading theory at the moment. But there's still, like, a whole debate among scientists. But the leading theory for a very long time was that it was like from a bat to another animal to a human.
Yeah.
But because like that feels so inconsequential, like, oh, it came from a bat, that's so small. but it had such a huge impact. Mm-hmm. So people tend to think about it symmetrically, like, oh, it had a huge outcome, so it must have a huge intricate cause. And that is, of course, like the guy you heard at the beginning. Who did you say? Bill Gates is behind all of it?
Yeah.
And that is like a prime example of how we sometimes tend to simplify narratives. And because, and it cannot technically be disproven because, like, whichever way you talk about it, it's like, oh no, that's just fake data. So once you enter that kind of that conversation that way,
there's no point to arguing. There is just, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. So if we are constantly processing our chaotic environments and we don't trust the grand narratives that like we've grown up with, then we are going to simplify the world. So right now I want to show you a clip from, at first you hear a scientist talking about kind of how conspiracy theory belief is created. And after that you hear a clip from a flat earth convention where one of the speakers is talking about how among the flat earth society, like it's an actual society, he found community. And that is something very important because that's where you find your new culture, in a way.
Right.
The less plausible your dogma is, the less it meshes with reality, the larger the alternative reality you're going to have to create. All of existence, suddenly, is through a different lens. I want to believe this. This doesn't mesh with reality, so don't change my view. Change reality.
You know, I do wonder what the motivation is for it. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
It's their escape. I'm in a room with people that absolutely will not judge me.
So many of you have been through so much pain.
My entire life, I've kind of felt separate, like nothing was quite right.
We never really fit in. We find ourselves to be somewhat isolated. And we want to talk to people about this thing, but nobody wants to talk to us.
So, as you can hear, these are all like members of the flat earth community who are saying that they've been through traumatic experience, that they felt left out all their lives. So essentially they were left alone by, well, society.
That was so sad. Honestly, I feel so bad for them.
And like one of the leading flat earth society members, he's called Mark Sargent. We'll have a clip from him later. He, like, I was watching that documentary and I was like, he seems like such a friendly person. Like, a genuinely really nice person. So it feels wrong to ridicule like conspiracy theorists like that.
Honestly, it kind of... this is probably not where we're going with this podcast, so I'll just drop it after a second. But it kind of reminds me of, like, the essence of being part of a cult. And I know that's, like, a huge... like, I'm really going there. But, yes. Like, I wrote a column on Scientology once, and actually, like, an old friend of my father's... yeah, has like a really high position within Scientology in the Netherlands. Like, you can Google him and everything. So I just kind of did some research. I know. And I did some research on that. And I feel like it's the same thing where, like, you find this whole community because you want to reject these basic values of science and family and what it's supposed to mean and death and basically everything, spirituality. And they kind of form their own community. And within that community, they all think the same. And that must be so comforting. And that's kind of what I'm hearing here as well.
Yes, exactly. So, as that fragment showed you, many of them have gone through a lot of difficult stuff, and they felt like the cultural hegemony and like the political situation and everything, it wasn't conducive to them. Like as I said, Mark Sargent seemed like a really friendly guy, and many of them seemed like really intelligent people, like critical thinkers,
yeah,
who just like they have scientific minds. They are scientific minded in that they want to research, they want to question things. And they, it's also something you saw in the documentary, is they were actually doing scientific tests. They didn't believe the outcomes that showed that the world was round, but
because that was going to be my next question, like, do they trust the scientific process?
Like, in that documentary, they are doing this experiment with... okay, again, I'm not a scientist, so I don't understand actually what they were doing, but they were explaining it in the documentary. It's like there's this device and that kind of measures the Earth's angle, and they seem to really trust this, but then when that experiment that they were doing showed that, oh no, it's actually, you know, there is a curvature to the Earth, so the Earth is round, they said, oh no, there was a flaw in our methodology.
But I don't understand. Like, that must be so stressful when you don't trust, like, the one resource that you just have this idea and that's all, like, it's not based on anything. It's not that I don't respect it. I genuinely don't understand.
Yes, I mean, I also find it very difficult to understand. But at some point, this is also something they mention in the documentary, you become such a part of this community and other people outside of the community don't want to talk to you anymore. They're like, oh, you're a flat earther. You're a fucking weirdo.
Yeah.
You know? So they lose touch with other people and this becomes their new found family. So it's not like you can leave, even if you don't necessarily believe in it anymore. This is still your new family.
Yeah.
And that's also something in the next fragment that I'm going to show you right now that really shows how much of, like, how attached you become to a community like this.
A lot of people realize that if you're a flat earther, you can only date flat earthers once you get into it, because it's too much of a paradigm shift. So there's now flat earth dating sites popping up. Ever since the whole flat earth thing started, I start getting merchandise in the mail.
So this was Mark Sargent, and he is really kind of a celebrity in the flat earth world. Like, if you're a flat earther, you likely know his name.
Okay.
And he's talking about how it's actually community, and he also feels so, like, respected in that community. Like, as you said, people send him merchandise, and there was a shot of him at the convention where people would come up to him and want to, like, take photos and give him gifts.
Oh my God.
So it's not just, you know, believing in something like, oh, the earth may be flat. It is finding a new community in a room full of people who are not judging you, who are there to, like, love and support you. So you create this new cultural hegemony where you're not alone anymore.
Yeah, I guess that's also, there was this a show on, I think it was National Geographic, and it was about, I think it was called either Searching UFO or Chasing UFO, one of those, and they also had all these UFO conventions, and I also got to thinking, if you think you've had an experience with a UFO, which you had, obviously, this is also, like, this has nothing to do with anything, but I always thought the UFO was literally like an alien ship, but it's
unidentified flying object. Yes.
So you can see a UFO. That's just something that confused me. But anyway, I feel like it must be comforting when you think, like, when you've seen a UFO, let's just put it like that, and you must be kind of scared as to what it was, and nobody wants to believe you. I feel like it must be so comforting to then go to a convention where everyone in that room has had the same experience. And I think that's kind of the same idea.
Yes, very much so. And I think that with Flat Earth, as Mark Sargent also said, it's a huge paradigm shift. And it really allows you to essentially let go of all the stuff that you felt like abandoned you, like the political environment that you felt excluded from, that you felt was oppressive to you. You can just step away from that and be like, no, they are all liars. Like, they are all shape-shifting lizard people from the triangle people. What are they called?
Triangle people?
With the eye in the triangle.
Illuminati.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, really? We're talking about Illuminati now. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're going all the way. But this really... So if you can say, like, oh, they're all lying or they're all corrupt or... You know, they're all shape-shifting alien lizard people from the Illuminati.
Sure.
Then you can, like, fully reject it and create your own environment. So it's also, it's like something comforting.
I've never thought about it like that. That's so interesting.
Yeah, so people almost become overly critical. And there's this one scientist. His name is Lamar Glover. He is a physicist. And he says something very interesting about these conspiracy theorists.
Truthers, flat earthers, anti-vaxxers. When we leave people behind, we leave bright minds to mutate and stagnate. These folks are potential scientists gone completely wrong. Their natural inquisitive and rejection of norms could be beneficial to science if they were more scientifically literate.
So what Lamar Glover here is saying is that we essentially have left these scientific-minded people alone. Like, that's also what I was trying to get at, because I think he put it into words very well, is they aren't bad people. They are people who want to, you know, investigate and question things, and that is a good thing. They just, like, they felt so excluded by society, essentially, that they can't, or at least that they don't want to function in the current political climate. And that is, of course, something that causes a lot of tension in politics. In some cases, conspiracy theories actually turn into, like, political action. So, I mean, America is a dystopia of itself. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the Capitol riots after the elections, like, one of the biggest guys was a QAnon conspiracy theory leader.
Yeah.
So it can actually result in political action. And sometimes political action that challenges the cultural hegemony and the grand narrative can be good, like going for societal change, for women's rights, for rights for people of color, for gay rights and things like that. But yeah. Flat earth rights, that makes it like you're not necessarily discriminated as a flat earther per se. It's just that,
I mean, it is a prejudice for sure. But I do think it's important to note that Black Lives Matter is not a conspiracy theory.
Oh, no, definitely not.
In the sense that I think the main thing, if I'm saying this correctly, for conspiracy theorists, is that you're after something you think or you're sure that happened, but you can't see it. Whereas,
yeah, I was, just to be sure, clear, I wasn't equating BLM to conspiracy theories.
Disclaimer, everyone.
Yeah, the big disclaimer. I was saying that it is a challenge to the cultural hegemony.
Oh, yeah.
And conspiracy theories are too, but in a very different
way.
And,
yeah.
You know, things like Black Lives Matter and queer pride parades and stuff like that, those are important things and that need to happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, sure.
But those are challenges also to the cultural hegemony, and those are founded in, you know, very big beliefs in equality and things like that. But when you look at it, like, these conspiracy theories, they, like, most of them are likely not true. I don't want to be, like, ridiculing conspiracy theories, because, as I said, I don't think they're, most of them are bad people.
Well, this is interesting, because obviously, also for me, my reaction is that is not true, because I believe in science. And, like, because I support science in the sense that it is the foundation for everything I think I know. Whereas, for example, in the Middle Ages, the Bible was what science is to us now.
Yes, exactly.
So,
and actually at that time, saying that the earth was round is a conspiracy theory.
Exactly.
And the rest is keeping it from us and saying it's flat.
So it's I feel like I'm already kind of beginning to understand how conspiracy theory and cultural hegemony are so connected. Because, like, it all depends on the cultural hegemony that you live in, what a conspiracy theory is.
Yeah.
And I just think it's funny that, like, you don't even know how far that goes. Like, I just think, for me, I say without thinking about it that it's not true. And I never really realized that I only say that because I live in a society where science is the foundation of all knowledge, basically.
But sometimes it's very difficult to distinguish that from genuine political movements. Like, as we just said, obviously there's a huge difference between Flat Earth Society and Black Lives Matter. But there are also movements that come closer to, like, is this, like, a conspiracy theory and is this wrong? Or is this a genuine, you know, politically motivated, important action?
Like the anti-vaxxer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, or the people who are saying that, you know, the coronavirus was man-made.
Yeah.
Like, there is no conclusive evidence yet that it wasn't.
I mean, that is true, yeah.
And with anti-vax, I mean, I myself am pro-vaccination, but I understand that people are worried about it. And those things come much, often tend to come much closer to, like, the edge of, like, should we just write this off as conspiracy nonsense? Or should we actually, you know, consider it and...
Well, I think the endearing thing is that it is all based on human rights as well. So we all, like, let's say, so we're on this side, we're like, I mean, we both want to get vaccinated, but then there's people who absolutely do not want that. But we both, like, both parties want human rights. And we both approach it differently because we feel like it's a matter of public health and we have to do this in order to get back to normal. And we trust medicine. We trust modern medicine. Whereas these anti-vaxxer people, they want just as much, like, they want human rights as much as we do. But they think they can protect people by keeping them from vaccination.
Yes, in the end, we all want to be safe. And in order to feel safe within your cultural hegemony, there needs to be a grand narrative that's very strong, but at the same time not too conservative, because we still need it to change and evolve with society. And that is also, again, that the researcher that I read, Agar, said, is that like grand narrative needs to be flexible to a certain extent, but not too flexible, because then life becomes too chaotic and we need a narrative to mediate the chaos. That's actually also something we talked about in the art episode. It's like art mediated the chaos, and now the stories we tell ourselves about the world mediate chaos.
And that also ties in with the mythology episode, because we talked about how myths are created around things that people can't explain, and they find comfort in creating a story for themselves.
Exactly. And that's often how many of the grand narratives that we know today started, with like people trying to explain the world to themselves, and then they became incredibly complex over time, like through history. But when you start a new grand narrative from scratch now, that tends to still be very simplistic. Because I remember saying about one of the authors, I think it was Hesiod, the first one we discussed, is that I said he was very, like, he simplified it, but he still didn't explain anything.
Right.
And that's kind of where these things start, and then they evolve into very complex stories and, you know, truth, essentially, or the way we see our environment truthfully. Yeah.
I mean, as far as we know, there might have been some conspiracy theorists back in the classical period, too. I mean, we don't know.
I mean, very likely, yes, because all it takes for a theory to be a conspiracy theory is to say that, like, it's a theory because it has not been proven yet. We're still, you know, researching, looking for answers. And then conspiracy means that several people need to be conspiring, like working together, often to a malicious end.
Yeah.
Sometimes conspiracy theories can be true. The Watergate scandal in America started off as a conspiracy theory until it was proven with documentation and stuff. So conspiracy theories aren't necessarily wrong. It's just a theory that people are conspiring against a certain group.
Yeah.
Again, Agar, he was saying that grand narratives have that capacity to be incredibly flexible and incredibly solid at the same time. But as we're seeing nowadays with, for example, the creation of conspiracy theories, it's not as stable as we would like, I think.
Yeah.
It's incredibly difficult to find the right balance there. And this is just like my personal in-between theory, is that maybe democracy also, like, it encourages critical thought and like thinking for yourself and having your own opinions. And obviously, having grown up in this democratic society, I think that too. But it also encourages us to step outside of the grand narrative more often.
Yeah, definitely.
And especially, you know, with the filter bubbles creating much more polarization, because my filter bubble can be the complete polar opposite of that of a conspiracy theory. So we constantly get different information.
Yeah. So I think that's also why I feel like political differences, obviously that's not a conspiracy theory, but I was just thinking about it because, like, having different political opinions can break up friendships, it can break up relationships, like, it goes so far because you believe something and you can like the other person a lot, but still, like, when your fundamental ideas about what is wrong, what is right are different, it's so hard to have that common ground in that sense.
And, you know, differences like that in opinions have been there since, like, the dawn of time, I think. I mean, I wasn't there.
Probably.
But, but it's kind of amplified in our modern world, I think, because, like, we used to always, in our cultural hegemony, be exposed to the same cultural hegemony. But more and more often, we see these, like, diverging grand narratives and people just stepping away from the cultural hegemony. And that's, conspiracy theorists are an example of that. But I also noticed that, for example, already when I'm talking to my brother, he has like a completely different filter bubble, and so do his friends. So he has completely different influences shaping his worldview than I do. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think he is like that different from me in the end, because we still, you know, come home and eat at the same dinner table and influence each other there. But more and more often we are pulled so far apart from the people in our environments.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you think there's a solution to this?
Oh my God, no. Honestly.
We're doomed.
No, I think it all depends on, like we've been discussing, what kind of community you live. And that also changes over time. Like, obviously, my major is psychology. And I did a course where there was like a part about developmental psychology. And about how when you're an adolescent, your peers are the most important people in your life. So it kind of shifts from like your parents being role models to your friends being role models. And then it kind of becomes like this, I think after that, like in your late adolescence is when you start to really develop your own sense of identity.
Yes.
But that changes over time. So I think something like this can never truly be resolved, because it's funny that you mentioned that, because I also have a brother and we went to the same school. He did a different level than I did. And he lives by himself. He has a couple of friends that I don't know. They come from a different town as well. So because he is still, I think he sees his friends more than he sees me, for example. So he follows their opinions and he agrees with them on topics that I disagree with. So even though, yeah, we do all come home to the same place, but I feel like in his, like in this time of his life, his friends are more important to him. So I think differences like these, they all depend on what you're surrounded with, and that changes all the time.
Yes, I just think that it changes faster now than it did, for example, in the Middle Ages. Like,
yeah.
If you had a woman in the Middle Ages, her youth would probably have been very comparable to the youth of her daughter. Like, they would have had very similar life trajectories. Yeah. But when I look at my mom or my grandmother, like, their childhoods were so different, like, that things are changing so rapidly now that the divide only becomes bigger.
Yeah.
And when you come of age, like when you have that sort of period where you're first learning that, oh, I can think different things from my parents. Yeah. I am an individual in such a chaotic environment again, because we're so exposed to so much chaos. It, like trying to find your political opinion that you feel is right, but also not extreme, and also not all of these other things, it becomes incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that you added that psychology perspective, because I also interviewed that psychologist. Again, that was like, I think 2 or 3 years ago. So it's been a while. But yeah, he said something very similar. Like, we're just being so, like, we are critical and we have to be more and more critical. And there's more and more chaos.
Yeah.
So that is how kind of how chaos and politics are related. We need kind of this cultural hegemony, this like political figure to just tell us what to believe. We want something to follow. And that's also what you see. Like, people with extreme beliefs often follow like a very specific dogma, or they have a leader essentially.
Yeah.
Very regularly.
But I also think for us, I think it also depends on what kind of society you live in, because I know for a fact that like us, I think most Western or Western European societies are more individualistic. So
yes.
You really get to flourish in being your own person. And I think obviously it's great that we have, at least again, I have to correct myself. I think it's great because I come from such a society. I keep forgetting how much like my environment shapes. So it's so crazy. But when you start to think about it, you go down a rabbit hole, because
yes,
like my society is what shaped my opinions. But anyway, let me just put it this way. I'm used to it, and therefore I appreciate the freedom that comes with it. Whereas I think, for example, I think it was Japan. Japan has a very like collective sense of community, whereas a person on their own, I mean, obviously they matter, like their life matters, but like people are significant when they're together, and their whole society is shaped around being there for one another. And so I feel like when you come from that kind of society, maybe personal or cultural or political differences don't occur as much.
Yeah, this is also like, I haven't done a specific research into this, but this is like a theory that conspiracy theories are less or at least extreme beliefs are less likely to form like this, to diverge so far from the cultural hegemony in societies where the cultural hegemony is more like unitary. Like, part of our cultural hegemony is being individual, but if that's not part of your cultural hegemony or the grand narrative, then it's also less likely that you're going to assert that. That is something that's worth looking into, because I do think that's a very, like, a societal difference.
Yeah.
So here in our Western society, there is this idea that maybe the only way we can kind of manage our chaotic environments but still keep our political environments stable is by maintaining, like, societal systems at the edge of chaos. So allowing some chaos to seep in to allow for the flexibility, but still kind of keeping some sort of rigid structure at the same time, so that we're not constantly exposed to all the chaos.
Oh, but that's kind of seems like a dangerous balance. Like,
yes,
it must be hard.
Yes, it's very hard to find that balance even. Basically, there is no other solution if we want to keep believing in free will and things like that. We also need to kind of believe in a grand narrative so that we don't fall apart as a society. But in the end, we have yet to find a perfect way to deal with chaos in our, like, cultural and political environments. And that is, of course, a question that we all need to answer for ourselves. Like, to what extent are we affected by our cultural hegemonies? And what do we want to believe? And how do we think this can be solved? And those are all questions you can answer in our interactive journaling experience. This brings us to the end of our podcast. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you really enjoyed it, and the rest of the series, of course, if you haven't listened to the first three episodes yet.
And if you have listened to them in order, you have come to the very last episode, and we really hope that you enjoyed this journey through the different perspectives on chaos.
Yes. Again, you can find our interactive journal on chaos101.site.uu.nl. And there are also chapters on the psychology and human interpretations of chaos in there. So there's still much more to explore, even if you have gone through all of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed this, and we thank you for listening to our podcast, and we hope you also will participate in the journaling experience.
Thank you. Bye, guys.